Welcome to the Skip to the End podcast. This is a completely different episode for us. It's a one-off special, which is Skip to the End meets Funeral for a Friend. As always, I'm Mark.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Adam.
How's that? That's thrown you off a bit, hasn't it?
It's weird.
Very. But this is a 45-minute special episode. We got the chance to meet Matt Davis, singer of the amazing British rock band Funeral for a Friend. They've been going nearly 15 years now. We got to basically catch up and go to their gig in Nottingham, and Matt was good enough to give us 45 minutes of his time. We were going to try and edit this down to 10 minutes, but it was gold. So we said, do you know what? As a one-off, we're going to put this out and give everybody the full, uncut 45-minute interview.
Okay, so we're here with Matt from Funeral for a Friend. So thank you for joining us, Matt.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Midway through a tour, how's it going?
Really good. I mean, I think we're at that age now as a band. I mean, we're almost in our 15th year that we just kind of do casual touring. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that. It's just we do weekends and then kind of spend the weekdays at home. But yeah, it's cool. It's been fun.
So are you all now sort of married with kids? Is that why you do the weekends?
More or less. I mean, you know, I've got like a wife and 9 cats and 2 rabbits. So for me, that's the closest I get to domestic bliss. But yeah, we've all got relationships, you know, and families and stuff. So, you know, we kind of know where our band is and what we want from our band and how we want to work it, so we're able to afford ourselves some time to chill and enjoy real life.
Doing it 14 years doing it, then naturally that's what you're going to want, aren't you?
I mean it's cool. I mean, I like being busy. I like, you know, touring. I like travelling around, but it's also nice to be able to kind of balance that with home life.
Matt, I've been a fan of Funeral for a Friend from the start, so I had your first EP before you brought out Casually Dressed. With a album that you bring out as a statement as your debut, so Casually Dressed and Deep in Conversation for me is up there with Neon Handshake, is up there with Ideas Above Our Station. It's that go-to album to sum up that kind of time. When you release an album like that and you get the success of 3 top 20 singles, which is unheard of now for a decent rock band, to follow it up, what's the pressure like to think, shit, we need to try and beat this?
Well, I don't know. At the time, we didn't really have the opportunity to kind of fully realize what was going on, so we didn't have that pressure because we were unaware that our band and that record was going to be held in such high regard. I mean, you know, the whole thing with that record for us, it was such a blur making it that when we came to making our second record, it actually felt like we were making our first record because we actually started from scratch. We wrote songs from the ground up. We didn't rely on material that existed on previous EPs to pad the album out, because we bullshitted our record label at the time. told them that we had more songs than what we did. So for me, I mean, it didn't really factor in. I mean, it's, you know, I feel incredibly humbled by the fact that, you know, now, you know, 14 years after the, you know, the fact, or 13 years, whatever it is now, and after Casually Dressed came out, that people took to that record so crazily. It's mind blowing. I mean, to this day, when we play the songs off that record, it's just a reaction that you just can't quite fully fathom. I mean, it's, you know, making a record is a very personal experience. Like writing songs is a very personal experience. I don't write words thinking of other people in mind. I write them from experience, from whatever filters in through my brain, you know, and makes sense to me. So to have people come up to me and say that so and so song has changed their lives or saved them, I just can't quite. And I tell them honestly, I said, I don't know how to process that information. I mean, I feel incredibly grateful that you feel so passionate about what, you know, I wrote as a 16-year-old in my bedroom, you know what I mean? But it's just crazy.
One of the other questions I had around that album, obviously you followed up then with the second album, did you know that you wanted a certain sound to your production? Because I know you got to work with the guy that did the drum sound from Deftones, White Pony,
Pantera, everything.
I want that drum sound, I want that production?
It wasn't necessarily the drum sound. Production, yeah. I mean, some of the records that Terry's done are just incredibly flawless, natural sounding records, which, given the process that Casually Dressed was, where it was very clinical, it was something that I really hungered for. And Terry was just everything I'd hoped he would be. I mean, he was easygoing, he was very chill, he was very organic, let the music and the band do all the talking, not, you know, computers and editing and doing a million takes and then splicing them all together to create the perfect one. You know, it was warts and all with Terry, which is, in my eyes, coming from the scene of music that I'm from, that's what it's all about. I mean, it's about portraying the full spectrum of emotions and loving that, you know what I mean? It's not trying to have some weird sense of perfection. It's about letting the kind of the little quirkiness of performances, whether it's a voice breaking here or overly aggressive there or something like that, you know, even like a duff note kind of mixing in, because it's real. And he said the way he said it is like, that's what your band is, it's life, you know what I mean? It's not perfect, it's got everything and anything in it, so your music should as well. So
yeah.
And Terry was amazing. He had me sing out in the streets in front of people, like people walking past. It was the most incredibly rewarding experience of making a record I think I've ever had.
I've got one more music question, then I want to knuckle down and talk for ones of you. For me, when I was growing up and listening to albums, there's one album that then suddenly changes your whole music taste, that you can be listening to something and change it. So there's two albums for me. There's Biffy Clyro, Black and Sky, and Pinkerton by Weezer.
Fair play.
When I listened to that album, everything for me changed in literally a blink. I was like, now I need to explore and not listen to any of the other shit I've ever listened to.
Yeah.
Tell me, has there been an album that you've listened to where you've gone, this is it?
You've just named one. Pinkerton by Weezer. Yes,
yeah.
I mean, I love the Blue Album. I mean, when I first discovered Weezer, and obviously, like everybody at my age, when MTV still was relevant and still played music videos, Buddy Holly totally blew my mind. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like that, so I got massively into Weezer. I sent my brother out to Cardiff when he was going down there with my uncle with a mission of bringing back Buddy Holly single on cassette. He came back with the whole album on cassette, which blew my mind, and I just you know, locked myself in my room for weeks, just deciphering it, learning it, figuring out the ins and outs of this album. And then Pinkerton came out, and I was left feeling a little bit on the back foot because I didn't anticipate the rawness of the record. And for the first point, I mean, you know, a lot of people, when they hear a record like that, they instantly dismiss it, thinking, oh, that's shit, because it doesn't follow the same, you know, production pattern as the first record. But for me, I mean, I, you know, if I spend my money on something, back then when I did, I would, regardless of if it hit me first or not, I would just spend weeks listening to it, determined to figure out what this record was. And it literally, and you, when you have that kind of epiphany moment when you, I think it was the song Tired of Sex, repeatedly over and over again, and just the way everything just kind of felt like it was about ready to fall apart, that entire record, at every point, but still held itself together very beautifully in a massive chaos, it just blew my mind. And then from that point, I mean, it just really opened up so many doors. Like you said, I mean, for me, at that point was quite an important step for me, because a friend of mine also gave me a cassette. His older brother gave him a tape of two hardcore bands that he didn't like. He didn't quite get it, so he passed it on to me. And at that point, getting the chaos of Pinkerton allowed me to fully translate the chaos of hardcore bands like Youth Today and Gorilla Biscuits in terms of the sentiment, and the message was equally as important as the production values, you know. So that opened, it was like a gateway drug, really, to be honest, to a scene of music which has been a huge part of my life ever since.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I picked the right album to mention. I was going to pick that one, Hell's the Hero, so I'm glad
I mean, I'm a huge Weezer fan, so
yeah.
I mean, I own every version of every record, whether it's the deluxe edition to the vinyl analog remasters, like 40 bucks. I mean, I love that band so much.
So let's get on to movies. Before we started recording, you mentioned a little bit about some of the things you watch on the tour bus. So give us an indication of the kind of movies that you've been watching whilst riding the road the last few weeks.
Well, to be honest, recently we've been devouring the recent film that we watched. I think some of the guys watched. I wasn't there when they were watching. It was Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
Which I had to go up and buy myself then, because everybody was talking about it on the van so much. But on the drive up, we're watching The Killing Fields.
Yeah.
People might not be totally, you know, aware of, like, the kind of stuff that they just assume bands, I guess, will watch, like, stupid, shitty comedies, like Farrelly Brothers stuff, like, whatever, which we do. But, yeah, I mean, we go the run. I mean, like, Killing Fields, The Burbs, everything from Hammer horror stuff, classic kind of, like, slasher films as well. A huge horror fan, a genre fan, so for me, around the time whenever we're on tour in October, it's literally horror movie month. So everything, like the Halloween box set, gets a caning. Everything, you know, so it's a bit of a mixed bag of tricks, really, to be honest with you. With Nil Nye gets a viewing consistently because it's quite possibly one of the most quoted movies in amongst ourselves as a band, so it's, you know, it's nice to have, you know, a band full of people who appreciate movies.
Absolutely. And what were the big films or the big directors for you as a younger man?
I mean, you know, growing up and stuff, I mean, I was, you know, obviously into your Indiana Joneses and your Star Warses and stuff like that. But when I got into movies really seriously in my teenage years, and I went to university to study it as well. So, you know, directors like David Lynch were just a massive eye-opening experience for me. And then I felt weirdly through that, you know, through like watching Lost Highway and Blue Velvet and stuff like that, and going back through films which I didn't realise were David Lynch films at the start. You know, when you watch them as a kid and you think, you know, when you watch Dune, you know, as a young adolescent, you think this is crazy, you know what I mean? But it's something you just can't help but be drawn to. I didn't know that was a David Lynch film at first, so I went back there and rediscovered that, and, you know, Elephant Man and things like that. And then that led me on to directors like Terrence Malick and stuff, and, you know, Badlands and, you know, Days of Heaven, which is one of my all-time favourite movies. And then into everything. Into totally everything. I mean, I'm in my DVD collection and my Blu-ray collection is, you know, one of those things now where you've asked me questions about it and I'm getting the whole thing of, oh, what do I pick? Who do I pick? But, I mean, David Lynch is a staple for me. I mean, he was like we're talking about, you know, Weezer being a gateway thing, was one of those directors whose movies I had to see everything, and then it just opened my world up massively.
And you say you studied film at university?
Yeah, I went to University of Wales College Newport and did the film and video course there for 2 years, and wanted to be a filmmaker, and I was so not ready for it at the time. I was just like sat there in lectures talking about directors, and I'd already done, like, gone out in my own time, bought books, read everything, and they were covering stuff that I was already kind of like, I want to just grab a camera and start kind of like getting out there and doing it. And so I used to just do that. I used to spend my student loan on just getting Super 8 and stuff and 16mm stuff and making movies with my friends and all that kind of jazz, you know, whatever you could get your hands on. So for me, getting into, like, you know, foreign language movies was a big deal. You know, getting into the French New Wave stuff, and, you know, especially François Truffaut and stuff, was a big, big thing.
I'm going to throw it out there already, right? On our podcast, nearly every, well, it's our theme going forward. We do our top five horrors, we do our top five comedies, we're going through everything.
You should have told me this in about the guard.
We do have a week to prepare in between, so we spend a lot of thought into this, but I'm going to go all out there now, right?
Right.
Top five films of all time.
God, let's see if you can do it.
You're on stage in 2 hours. Just
Well, Blue Velvet has got to be one, because that is my perfect David Lynch film. Mm-hmm. So what else would it have to be after that? It probably would be, and this is going to be a weird one, but The Princess Bride.
Nice.
I want the explanation to go with this.
Big Andre the Giant fan.
I mean, it's one of those, you know, it's, when you're growing up, it's just one of those, you know, growing up in the 80s, you experience a lot of kind of like fantasy genre movies like Dragon Slayer and stuff like that, things that a lot of kids these days don't even get to fully comprehend because it's all laid out for them, you know, films like Willow. But Princess Bride had just that weird quirkiness to it, that just real sarcastic biting humour that was just, I'd never experienced before as a kid, you know what I mean? It was just like, you know, Mandy Patinkin is, you know, Inigo Montoya, just the whole thing of the over flamboyance of it just was just like captivating. And even as an adult, when you come back to those films, it still means something to you. Mm-hmm. You know, so I judge movies that I really love by that point, that, you know, as a 35-year-old I can watch a film that I loved as like an 8-year-old and be like, still got it.
Yeah.
Still got it. So that's two. Obviously Days of Heaven by Terrence Malick, because as a, you know, I studied cinematography in film school, and I'm massively into photography, so the visual elements, poetic elements of his movies really stand out to me, and that you know, the shots and the whole kind of magic hour moments in that movie just are just mind-blowing. You know, whenever I have a movie night where I have friends of mine come over, that's usually a movie that we just throw on because it's just, you can get lost in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love those movies like that where you can just,
yeah.
And even though the dialogue is so sparse, you just kind of, you feel like you're immersed in something really ridiculously special. So for me, that's a big one.
Two more.
Halloween.
Nice.
Halloween.
Yeah, as God.
Yes, pretty much, because I used to hate horror films when I was a kid. I mean, they terrify. When my parents used to watch them, I got a VHS van that used to come around and like have VHSs rented at the back of this van. You know, my parents used to, you know, get the kids' film, which my brother and I would watch, and then they'd get a film for themselves, which after we'd gone to bed, they would watch. And it, like, everything from RoboCop to Aliens to things like that. You know, my parents would watch, and I would sneak,
yeah.
You know, in the, you know, get up early the next morning and just be like, me and my brother would be like, you know, put it on. The first 10 minutes of these movies, just literally just like shocked, you know, and terrified for weeks. Nightmares. My parents couldn't really fully understand why we'd have so many nightmares, but it's down to the video van. So when Halloween came out, when I turned 18 and I got my opportunity to go to Blockbusters and give my details and be like, sign me up, I want to rent all your movies. I went straight to the horror section and they had Halloween 1, they had Halloween 2, so I got both. And I just remember just being all the lights out, just putting it on VHS, proper VHS now, in there. And just the music, it was just, that's what really spun me out. Because if you dissect it now, and as I've done many times, it's not a really, really scary film. The music and just really ups the ante of suspense in that. You know what I mean? It's just the way it just creeps in, the whole synth vibe of it, you know, and that's one of Carpenter's kind of so many strengths, is in that kind of way of elaborately kind of drawing you into the tension, not through the visuals to such, but just the way the music complements everything. And it's why I love The Fog as well, because it's just fuck, you know.
We just talk John Carpenter for the next
hour. It's so good. I mean, it's to the point where Halloween is a key film in terms of my love of horror, because it just totally just made me get it. I got it for the first time. You know, as a kid, I was like terrified, and I was determined to reassess my stance with horror films. And it just spun me. I literally went down the next day, got everything from Friday the 13th, all these kind of movies. I was going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But Halloween stays true as being one of the ones that I can consistently watch every year. I mean, I can put it on every year and be like, I love this. The moments in these movies are just, especially the first two, are just stupendously good.
Yeah.
I
guarantee you went and bought the Blu-ray Steelbook for the 35th anniversary.
No, I bought the Shout Factory, the Scream Factory. I've had all
the
various
box
versions.
Set.
I've got I've got the complete box set, which I sneaked past my wife. because it's, you know, I had all the different versions. I've actually got the single versions of the Halloween films as well. Like, so just, I've got the Steelbook. But for me, it's one of those series that, you know, keeps on kind of delivering so many good things. You know, even the lesser movies, if you want to, you know, call them that, because I think they complement each other so well. Even three. I mean, I deliberately avoided watching three for the longest time because I had nothing to do with Michael Myers,
mm-hmm.
and I felt that Halloween had everything to do with Michael Myers. But that's not necessarily true. I watched three for the first time Halloween last year. This is crazy how long I've gone without watching this film. And I was just totally blown away by it. I was just like, this is a really fucking cool little story. It's the main act, I can't remember the character's name, but the old guy who runs the mask company, he is he's more creepier than Michael Myers.
Yeah.
Incredibly so. I mean, it's just something about, I mean, you think like a mask is going to just, you know, creep you the fuck out, like nothing behind, just blackness behind the eyes, but this guy just, you know, the way he interacts with the actors and the other characters and the dialogue and the inflections is just, man, he was so fucking creepy. It's unbelievable. And that song, oh man, you know. Yeah, actually, I work in a record store part-time, so for me, as soon as I saw we had Death Waltz vinyl reissues of the soundtracks, I bought Halloween 2, I bought Halloween 3, and I bought The Fog. Gatefold things, because I was just, I love these are just as important as the movies themselves. Right, last one.
I'm still picturing someone coming in and saying, excuse me mate, have you got a Funeral for a Friend's album? You'd be like,
yes. Trust me, alright, last one.
No pressure now after that big speech about Halloween.
I mean, Halloween is a big deal. I'm trying to think. I won't do this list justice for my sake.
Guaranteed, you'll always find one afterwards.
Oh, there's so many. There's so many. I mean, you know, I spent so many years just, I watch movies, I love movies, so for me it always changes depending on my mood.
You'll be on stage tonight and you just think, why did I say that?
Mid-song.
I might say something on the microphone about it as well. Let me think quickly. It's probably going to be another genre film. It's going to be, I don't know, horror film probably.
The Thing.
Quite popular. we could be here for some time. No, it's going to be, I'm trying to pick which one of these. It's a Hitchcock film.
Oh
god, and even with the Hitchcock films there's too many. Right. Alright, Dial M for Murder.
Nice. Are you sure?
It was either that or Rear Window, and I think a lot of people go Rear Window I love Jimmy Stewart. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
Jimmy Stewart is quite possibly my first experience of a cinematic icon that I could iconically growing up, you know, see as being somebody special.
Mm-hmm.
Quite unique, because I mean, my parents used to watch The Death Out of It's a Wonderful Life. And even to the point where I got bored of it, then fell in love with it again. But Grace Kelly, Ray Milland, Dial M for Murder, incredibly, incredibly creepy in another different way. But I just love the dynamic between Milland's kind of subtly kind of like knowing, yeah, I know my wife is having an affair, but I'm just going to be really kind of like think about it, and then I'm going to try to kill you. I think some people don't rate it as highly as other Hitchcock movies, but I think it's so carefully plotted and so well constructed that I find it hard to not appreciate it in a way that is just very, a great little suspense film. You know, I mean, it's very claustrophobic because it's based in like the apartment basically. I just love films that kind of like you can move around in not very many locations, and I think Hitchcock was a complete genius about that. You know, look at Rear Window, for instance.
Yeah.
That's probably the reason why that's so high. You know, it doesn't really go anywhere in terms of like taking you to Mount Rushmore, you know, and stuff, north and northwest, and all these great locations that you can paint on a backdrop and kind of slap up there and put Cary Grant in front of and be like, yeah, this is budget right now. But I just think, you know, Dial M is just one of those films that stands out for me. I mean, it may not be everybody's favourite Hitchcock, but it's mine.
So what
your
choice?
Yeah.
So,
got your five.
Yeah.
So my question, we talk a lot about kind of what we refer to as pop culture black spots.
Yeah.
On our podcast. So it's like films that when you tell someone you haven't seen it, they think you're crazy. They don't know how you've missed it. Do you have any massive gaps in your film watching?
Probably. I mean, I try to, you know, if there's something that I've been told about and I'm like totally shocked that I haven't seen it, then I will do my utmost to kind of track it down. And
you did with Nightcrawler.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Nightcrawler. And like, that's, you know, when I hear my guys ring about a film that they like, I mean, it's just a thing like Birdman. I haven't seen that yet, so I'm gonna be like, you know, I want to see. I know. Yeah, I mean, I don't get the opportunity to go to the. You know, I love going to the movie. I love going to the cinema. I love the experience. I don't get to do it as often as I like, because A, it's becoming ridiculously expensive.
Yeah.
B, I haven't got the time all the time to go and do it. So usually I wait for the DVDs, like the Blu-ray to come out, and I just kind of like lock myself away in my little room and just, you know, all the lights out, just get it on there and let it go. It's like I did, like I bought like around Christmas time when Arrow put that fucking 30 quid up or whatever, 20 quid.
Mm-hmm.
3 DVDs, 20 quid. I went batshit crazy. I mean, I picked up so many movies. You know, Big Trouble in Little China, Blu-ray. You know,
that soundtrack.
Yeah.
so unbelievable.
So good. I mean, and as a Carpenter film as well, it's one of the ones that, you know, in our band that we love.
Yeah.
So that was a given. So, you know, and things like Maniac Cop and films like that that
cool.
I missed out on, you know, all these like little video nasties doing the interview. Yeah, all my friends, older brothers and stuff like that, and parents were into and thought, you know, the kids can't watch that, whatever. Like, you know, Robocop and Aliens and stuff. And I've just started to kind of reconfigure out and get myself around to, you know, there's so many great films from that era that I just totally wasn't aware of.
They just need to set up a bank transfer for me every month. Like last week, I bought Incredible Melting Man. Each week, something comes out. Yeah. I'm like, damn you, like you said, I don't need Roadkill right now.
For me,
but I bought it.
For
you know?
Me, it's like, I mean, it's. I was in the when Louise and everybody, you know, they brought like DVDs down for us to watch. I was totally blown away by that. I mean, it's we kind of, you know, get hooked up with stuff as well as a band, but I've never had anything like a video, you know, label kind of offered a kind of hook us up with stuff.
Yeah.
It was just like, that blew my tiny little mind a little bit. That did.
That's
just
the contact
like,
you want for life.
Yeah, and she asked them, she said the magic words, is there anything you're after? And I was like, well, dangerous territory right now. Dangerous territory right now. But no, I mean, it's, you know, Night of the Comet and stuff, films like that, that were, you know, I didn't fucking even you know, give any time to grow, you know, when I was
Shivers.
In film school. Yeah, David Cronenberg, I love David Cronenberg. Yeah. So that for me, you know, I got Rabid, Shivers, and you know, I'm anticipating more and more to come through them. But I'm really excited for the Sherlock Holmes, Hound of the Baskervilles, Hammer version, because that's like one of my all time favorite films. So yeah, when they announced that, I was just like, I was mad. I called a friend of mine up in Germany who's a massive Hammer fan, and he was freaking out about it as well. So, yeah.
Moving aside from movies a little bit,
yeah.
I was looking at your Tumblr earlier, and you sort of refer to yourself as a nerd.
Oh, yes.
So how does your nerdiness manifest? Other than movies, what are you really nerdy about?
I'm nerdy about comic books. Mm-hmm. I'm nerdy about stuff that kind of just like I guess you're passionate about, like photography. I'm a massive, you know, gearhead in terms of that stuff. I might bring my cameras with me everywhere, my bloody tripods in the corner. I was contemplating bringing my large format camera out with me on this run, but I figured that people might be a bit, you know, I'm supposed to be looking after everybody in this tour, and they might be a bit weirded out about disappearing for hours on end and turning up all this gear and, you know, stuff. But
so how about the comics?
Comics, yeah. I mean, I grew up like any self-respecting teenager, you know, when you pop into your local, you know, post office when you're an 11-year-old looking for something entertaining to laugh with, and you find a stack of these irregular-sized comic books that have American prices on them and have Superman, Captain Atom, Flash, Green Lantern and stuff. Just, I ran home, got some more money from my mother, begged her, and picked up like a whole wealth of stuff, like a lot of DC stuff, Green Lantern I've always been into.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Daredevil is pretty much my favourite superhero.
Yeah.
If you're more vigilante guy, but and I just, you know, I've always had a passion for you know, for comic books and stuff, going from everything through to, you know, from the indie stuff to the superhero stuff.
Is there anything that you're reading particularly at the minute?
I'm going through a lot of David Lapham's Stray Bullets stuff, because I just love the isolated individual stories in that entire series, and I think that's a kind of really interesting and very unique take on an anthology story, where you're not having to follow it through each issue. You know, every issue is self-contained, and I think that's, you know, incredibly interesting to read through, and it must be really difficult as a writer to kind of like to try to kind of come up with these kind of things. So I have a lot of time for David Lapham and stuff. But like the new 52 Batman stuff I've been catching up on for a while, because a friend of mine, she's a huge Batman fan, and we were having a conversation a year and a half ago when we were in London on tour, and I was just saying, oh, I haven't read any comic books in ages, and what should I read? I'm not sure, and she just gave me, she ran out and came back with the first volume of the Batman New 52. So I read that on tour, and it was the worst mistake she could make. I literally spend all my PDs and I'm catching up. But yeah, because I just love everything comic book wise, whether it's the TV series and stuff, like The Flash, The Arrow, Gotham.
Yeah.
I mean, Flash right now is just blowing my mind, because it's just the way it's so you know, incredibly moving forward so quickly. I'm just excited. I mean, I've got an episode yet to catch up on.
No, it's Flash is unbelievable.
I mean, it's great that people can take, like, historically when it's been a very difficult genre to try to make cool, and now it is. I think because the way people treated it is with a lot of respect and with a seriousness, which is really interesting, because they're not trying to treat it as tongue in cheek. They're giving a lot of respect to the source material, and the way they portray the characters is very real for a superhero thing. You know, Daredevil and Netflix coming on next month. I am
how excited!
I am freaked out by that. I mean, I've no words because I'm just genuinely thrilled. I can't wait to devour that whole thing in one go.
I think you've summed it up as well. They're getting the respect they deserve now. I mean, for a lot of time, it was perceived as a child's thing.
Yeah.
But anyone that actually read comic books realised these aren't really for kids.
No, I mean, you look at something like, you know, Constantine, which I don't think has been really given a fair crack at the whip by, I think it's NBC that it's on in the States.
Yeah.
But it's found its feet a bit now.
Yeah, it's good.
You know, apart from the dipping into the Welsh accent, you know, of Matt and everything, but it's, I generally think that being able to present, you know, almost like an anti-hero like that, in that kind of context, is TV has just come so far now that it's almost rivaling movies in terms that you can, what I love about TV is that you can develop character now, where movies, you've got like an hour and a half, 2 hours to, you know, get everything out there. Over the course of a season, you can really develop something.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the Avengers have tried to do that. They've put individual films in, and then the Avengers team assembles in a separate.
Yeah, it's just what I have a lot of respect for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I mean, that whole series I got really struggled with the first like five or six episodes of season one, and then all of a sudden, like somebody just took some fucking magic crack, like, and just like, you know what? We're gonna make this freaking awesome right now. We're gonna link this into so many cool things, and it was just like, you know, I think it was the cool thing with, you know, you bring Colin McLaughlin into anything, like, and it's just fucking kills it, you know.
Yeah.
But what the whole revelatory thing was just like, what are they building to? And it's like, oh fuck yeah, it's the Inhumans.
Yeah.
And when that clicks, it's just like, oh, you're freaking awesome right now. And it's just, you know, when the season two just came back, and I don't know if it's come back on the UK yet, in the UK, but it's come back in the States, and they're getting past the point of, you know, the revelation of Atlanta stuff, and the whole exploration of, you know, the mist and how it kind of like transforms
the origins.
And I was just like sat there just watching these episodes, just like, ooh, yeah, this is so goddamn good.
And that's going to be huge for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because they can't use the X-Men or the mutants, so they're going to have the Inhumans.
Yeah, I mean, it's something incredibly kind of brave to do. I mean, especially in a format of TV where ratings are so important to the networks that things can get cancelled at any point. So it's like, you know, I can't imagine the frustration of being like, you know, trying to work the in-between storylines here to build up something. Imagine if it gets cancelled, that'd be shit, wouldn't it? That'd be so bad. I mean, they'd probably find some other way of working it out, but I mean, I think, you know, I think the networks now have a lot more patience when it comes to programs like that and things, because they know that there's the popularity of the movies is going to translate into people eventually coming to see the possibilities of what genre kind of can do on TV as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Surprisingly, my next question was going to be about TV. Right, you're on a plane.
I am.
You're flying out.
Yeah.
You land on an island.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're staying here now.
Yeah.
No one else is here, but we're giving you a 50-inch plasma TV with surround sound.
I don't know how that's powered, but
solar powered.
You've got to sit on the bike and power it. But you've got one DVD box set to watch the rest of your life.
Easy.
Oh,
easy. Twin Peaks.
Nice.
It's coming back.
Or is it?
He's not signed the contract.
Yeah. Contract.
Don't tease us.
Twin Peaks. I mean, yeah, David Lynch. We're going back to David Lynch. But I mean, it was one of the things that when in my teenage years, that when it got a re-airing on the Sci-Fi Channel, me and a friend of mine who was also, we went to film school together. Monday nights were Twin Peaks nights, and he would come up, we'd hang out at my place, just pizza, Twin Peaks, we'd devour it, like, because it was just so unusual and so incredibly creepy and so incredibly a slice of America that we both desperately wanted to experience that I never thought I could, and I've been there. I mean, been to all the places that, you know, they filmed, you know, the locations and stuff, and I was just like a little fucking schoolgirl, man. I was just so excited. But yeah, I mean, I just love the quirkiness of it, how it you know, the melodrama, the soap opera, the horror, the thriller. How many genres can you throw into one TV, into one short-lived...
And do well.
Yeah. I mean, it's like... I try to explain it, because some people just don't get it, and some people do. It's kind of cool amongst kind of like kids, no? I mean, a lot of friends of mine who were like in their 20s and stuff like that have come to Twin Peaks totally kind of, you know, exploring it for the first time and realizing that it's, you know, that it's been used as a touchstone by so many programs, you know, that they love that are current, like, you know, things like Utopia and stuff like that. There are obvious nods to Twin Peaks. Even like, there's that TV show Psych. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
They had the Twin Peaks parody episode, which was, I think it was called Dual Spires or something like that. It was called, and they had cast members from Twin Peaks there, and it was practically like, I was sat there watching it because my wife, who's a huge Psych fan, and she was like, they've got an episode which is about Twin Peaks, and I was like, really? So I sit there and watch it. I'm loving it because I'm bringing up all these references, how they like, they've written in, because the main actor, he's huge Twin Peaks fans, which, he wrote the episode and he directed it, and that's why, you know. So I, as a fan, I was just like loving it, but it gets referenced so much, you know,
big time,
things like, oh, do you know what, even I could maybe do a tie, I could do the X-Files as well.
Another one that's coming back.
I mean, because it's, you know, both Twin Peaks and X-Files are pretty much two of my favourite TV things of all time, you know. For me as a teenager, again, it's like, oh, going back to those points where you're just witnessing something that is just totally new and fresh and exciting, and kind of taking a format that kind of existed in previous stuff but kind of making it super fucking special, because the acting is great, the writing is great. I mean, they're taking it with the right level of tongue in cheek, you know. So I mean, Twin Peaks wins, but X-Files comes close.
How about gaming? Are you much of a game player?
Yes.
Go on then, tell us about your nerdy obsessions with gaming.
I have a PS4, I have a PS3, I have an Xbox One, I have a 360, I have a Neo Geo. I've got a PC Engine, I've got Mega Drive, I've got bloody, I got a 3DO. Me and my brother, you know, we've loved video games since we were kids. I mean, since the NES came out.
Nice.
The first thing we had was the one with the Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game, and then Batman and stuff like that. And so, generally speaking, me and my brother have been nerds since birth, practically. in the best possible way. He's probably been a bit more of an avid gamer than me over the years, but, I mean, when there's a series of games or a game that comes out, I mean, like, Resident Evil is my favourite game of all time. Like, Resident Evil, Silent Hill, those two. I mean, as much as I grew up playing Mario and stuff like that, I think those games genuinely I love, because I found the idea of being scared, being in control of, like, you know, those kind of moments, just something incredibly fascinating. And, you know, I loved being scared at that point. So Resident Evil is like my bad boy game of all time. I just bought the remastered version now, so I'm eagerly, I don't get a chance to play as much as I do, you know, being married and stuff, and having the, you know, I don't have the time to spend by myself, which I love being by myself playing video games. But no, I've got some, you know, some plans to spend a couple of evenings going through that again. I can just play that game over and over again. It never gets boring. Same as Silent Hill.
Did you ever get round to playing the PS demo they released for Silent Hill?
Yeah.
That was scary stuff, man.
I mean, to be honest, I've never had... I literally had a little panic attack, almost shit my pants moment in that, where I had to double check that I didn't actually shit my pants. But that's just a testament to when somebody gets a hold of something like Kojima and knows the ins and outs of what makes that series so special, yet can turn it on its head and make it his own, yet still pay respect to the original vibe of the game. Yeah. It's amazing, because I think it's potentially going to be the creepiest Silent Hill game.
Oh, definitely.
That there has ever been. And I think it needs that. I think it needs, you know, gaming needs a good, really good fucking kick in the pants in terms of survival horror games, because The Evil Within was great, but it still wasn't quite there.
Lacked.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in terms of like, I mean, I'm not expecting there to be like another Resident Evil. I mean, I wish Resident Evil 6 was not Resident Evil 6, or Resident Evil 5 wasn't ready. I wish that, you know, 4, they should have stopped at 4. Technically.
Brilliant.
But Silent Hill, I think, has the potential of going back to the roots.
It could be a game changer series. Completely.
Yeah, I think, and I hope it's a learning curve for a lot of people in terms of, you know, developers and publishers, in terms of what can be achieved in the survival horror genre, to kind of step it up further. Because I think with the way horror films are going and stuff, and what's out there now, I mean, I watched Honeymoon the other day, which I totally didn't see that coming. Mm-hmm. But it was just like, you know, there are so many ways of incorporating the cinematic experience into video games to captivate people. Mm-hmm. Now more than any other time.
It could take horror cinema out, to be honest, if they release a great game.
There's going to be no need to do an adaptation and a shitty adaptation of a great, you know, video game like Silent Hill. At that point, just kind of make it all in one, encompass it all, like, yeah. You know what I mean, make the experience something. Yeah. That you know you don't need to go and I don't have to make a fucking film like
exactly
that.
I mean, this Silent Hill game, if it is as good as and scary as it needs to be, that you can make films redundant in that respect.
Yeah, so I'm hoping it doesn't, but I mean, because I do like, you know, the genre in itself, but I think in terms of video games, I think it could up the ante a lot. Yeah. So, you know, here's hoping that it delivers on all fronts.
Excellent.
And cool. I will add a little story to this. Norman Reedus,
actually,
who has been the main character kind of thing for the new Silent Hill game, Silent Hills, did a photo shoot with our band once. Wow. Years ago in New York, he took photographs of us for Nylon magazine, which was totally weird for me because I knew him from the I can't remember his character in Blade 2, but I literally was just like, dude, you're in Blade 2. What are you doing taking photographs of us? You're in Blade 2. It's like, oh man, I just, like, you know, we just sat there talking about Blade 2 and Guillermo del Toro, like, and it was just fucking mental. That's he crazy. Was awesome. He was like such a cool dude, like,
yeah.
Just so cash, and just be like, I was just like, none of my guys were like, who's he? And I was like, he's fucking Blade 2. He's in Blade 2, like. You know what I mean? He's not fucking Wesley. No, he's not.
Did you point that out now? He's in The Walking Dead as well.
Like, yeah, oh, dude, every time, all my friends, I just, like, it's one of those stories that I say, he took photographs of us. I got a photo somewhere of us, because we did it like a group photograph at the end of the shoot. So my dad's got it, I think, and I just liked him. Norman Reedus. Ace.
He's one of those guys that we're hoping to meet somewhere along the line at one of the conventions.
He is a really nice dude. Mm-hmm. Hands down, incredibly genuine, incredibly easygoing, top lad.
Awesome.
So that was the interview with Matt Davis from Funeral for a Friend. Cool guy.
Very cool guy.
Legend.
It just so warm and welcoming, and everything he said you're kind of hooked to.
Yeah, and I mean, let's get out of the way and say thank you to him, first of all, for getting us into the gig and allowing us to spend nearly an hour with him and chat to him on all kinds of topics.
I'm not going to lie, guys, if he wasn't busy every weekend touring, I would be probably asking him to submit an application to join Skips the End, because he was one of us.
And I like that there's an application.
Yeah, we're not guarantee you're going to get in, but we'll let you have the application form.
You probably shouldn't have said that, though, because now he knows that he'll probably apply, because even though he's got this, you know,
we're going to break up Funeral for a Friend.
Exactly. He's got this great rock band that's been going 14 years that he loves doing, but the opportunity to join Skip the End doesn't come along every day.
This is true. And he would fit right in, wouldn't he?
Perfectly.
Because his sort of pop culture bench of knowledge is huge. You know, we talked there about everything from movies to his musical influences to comics. I mean, Mark, you know, the fact that you mentioned that Pinkerton was a seminal album in your music going youth, and when you said that, his eyes lit up, because it was the same for him.
We're the same person. It's good. No, it's amazing, and I'm not just saying it, I'm a massive fan of his music. Casually Dressed and Deep in Conversation is one of the best debut albums out there. Mm. And, you know, to see that they're still going strong now, putting on such an energetic show, wow, what a gig.
Yeah, I mean, Adam, you did a review for it for skiptotheend.co.uk, and one of the lines that you put was that he was literally bouncing off the walls at one point, and he was. It was an old-school, hardcore gig. He was running left and right across the stage, jumping off the walls. It was great. The energy from the band and the crowd was huge.
Oh, it was great, and one of the things that makes me laugh about that was after the gig, we sort of spoke to him a bit more after that. We didn't get it we didn't record it, unfortunately, but he did say he regretted doing that because he was quite tired after it.
But yeah, a really good interview. I'm so glad that we've got the opportunity to put the whole episode out. I would have hated trying to cut this down to 10, 15 minutes. Yeah, I can't say anything else nice about him. He loves Arrow films as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was funny because when we went into his dressing room, on the table he had a couple of Arrow Blu-rays, and it was Network and Rollerball, two films that you got, Mark, on Arrow Blu-ray, and reviewed both for the website recently. So it was just funny that he had the exact same ones.
Yeah, he's a massive horror fan as well, and it was just that's I'd love to interview more people like that. You know, 45 minutes of his time, never felt rushed, happy just to sit there.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. So I hope anyone out there who's listened to this has enjoyed it. If you've not already listened to our full podcast that has a snippet of this interview but all the other fun stuff that we do, go on to Podomatic or iTunes and download our most recent episode where we reviewed Fast and Furious 7, and keep listening out for all future episodes of the Skip to the End podcast.